But James, I need you.
So does England.
Hello and welcome. This is another edition of the Odd Job Pod. I'm your host, Gary Andrews. We'll obviously have the usual irreverence and the usual fun that you'd come to expect from our podcast. But obviously this podcast is, I think, probably fair to say, tinged with a little bit of sadness. Between recording our last podcast and this one, sadly, Roger Moore passed away at the age of 89. And for many people, I think Moore was Bond. And we'll be exploring, really, Moore's career, his legacy, and just why he resonated so much with that Bond audience. But before I do, I obviously have to bring in my two co-hosts. So joining this coalition of chaos today, we have Graham Sibley and Terry DeFellin. Good evening, gentlemen.
Hello. Hello, Gary.
Hello. We've all got our eyebrows raised, certainly along have. With our martini glasses.
We certainly have.
We're all a nice shade of mahogany as well.
So nice safari suit there as well.
Thank you very much. Would you like a cigar?
Fancy a game of backgammon after this one?
Yeah. Fancy that.
I've got my old white tux and black tie. Yes, indeed.
Everything we're all ever really hope for, really.
Yep.
And I think that just even that little exchange probably sums up one of the reasons why I think Roger Moore was both an iconic for the role of Bond, but also incredibly well-loved as well. Even if perhaps, you know, some of his films don't quite stand up to the rest of the Bond canon, there's still a lot of charm and love in there. But so I'll start with you, Terry. There's obviously Moore left behind a huge legacy with Bond. And where do you even start with trying to, when you're looking back on Roger Moore's career and remembering him, where do you even start with trying to unpick the legacy that he left for Bond?
Well, I think that the thing that he leaves behind that is probably the strongest is that I think that he is the most loved James Bond. I think that his characterisation of James Bond was something that appealed to James Bond fans. I think that because he was a little bit more dashing, a little bit more humorous in his approach, less severe, less brutal than his predecessor, that I think that certainly a lot of kids who would have watched the Roger Moore Bond films would have seen him as a, you know, more of a kindly uncle. And I think he gave that element to the character that Connery didn't have, and that's great because Connery did his own thing. And I think that certainly from my recollection of watching those movies when I was a boy, being taken to the pictures to see Spy Who Loved Me, Moonraker, was that he always seemed to be a bit of a rock and a dependable character. And I wonder whether or not that's something that was then brought on in his successors.
Yeah, for Bond itself, as Terry sort of said, his approach and the way that he played the character couldn't have been more different from Connery.
No, not really. But it could have been very much like Ian Fleming. And a lot of people look at Bond and say, well, the genesis of this was Ian Fleming's life himself. But it's all the things that Ian Fleming would like to think that his life was. And the people who actually met him knew him as some loose guy who was just a bit of a snob and just waltz around going to parties and things like that. And Moore did actually know Fleming, or his paths had crossed, because and Moore had actually was quite well connected with Broccoli and Saltzman before actually being linked with the role, but it was I think it's that sort of sense that he brought across of just, well, I'm the snob that some ways even Connery didn't really carry off. He did try out quite a few times to do that sort of, like, you know, red wine with fish thing. And things like that, and when he was trying to tell M what the vintage of the wine that they made the sherry out of, and things like that. This is very sort of good Fleming stuff. But you can imagine also Moore delivering those same lines and completely cutting them down. I always think that when you look at Moore and judge him against Connery, look at the two scenes of Connery against Robert Shaw, Grant. So Bond and Grant on the train in that same yeah. scene when they're having the meal. And also when Moore's Bond and Christopher Lee Scaramanga are having their meal. And the interplay between the two. And you see the way that both of them take that sort of similar role, and they really do play it up. And both scenes are amazingly brilliant. I mean, mm. let's face it. I mean, Man of the Golden Gun is a problematic. Well, it's a troubled film. It's mm. not brilliant.
Yeah, but that scene is not amongst the problematic elements.
No, that is one of the things that quite rightly is one of the most memorable bits in mm. the film. And there are lots of memorable bits in there, but you wouldn't normally expect it to be a high action bit. All right, the Swanee whistle bit is another is another memorable bit. But I think that is one of the real signs of it, and the way that he does play that role, especially with when the protagonist is meant to be Bond's equal, and this is when all of Fleming's snobbery comes out. Mm. And so, well, actually not, because I'm actually a much higher class person than you are.
Scaramanga says refers to the true test of the gentleman.
Yeah.
And then Roger just cuts him down completely, and it's really scathing. It works really, really well.
But interestingly enough, I mean, the whole persona about Roger Moore, and the whole thing that he got typecast and everything, this was a guy from Catford, who was, when he was a jobbing actor when he was younger, was told to adopt this persona.
Mm.
And he just carried it through for the rest of his life. And,
yes.
And he said it just opened doors for him as soon as he did it.
I think that it's reasonable to say that he could have been a very diverse actor had his career taken a different path. But
an amazing mimic.
Yes.
An incredible mimic.
You and I have... I don't know, Gary, if you ever got the opportunity to go and see his show...
No, I never did, unfortunately.
Graham and I both did, and one of the things that comes out is that, yes, a tremendous mimic. Certainly a guy who is known for not being a terribly diverse, or in some people's eyes, a terribly good actor, but was classically trained to be an actor. Yeah, I mean, I would imagine that what's happened is that they've seen the look of him. He's a handsome fella, he's a big fella. And they've said, look, you know, you'll make money, you'll get jobs by playing a certain type of role. And yeah, I mean, he'd been typecast ever since. I mean, when he was under contract in Hollywood, I mean, he was playing pretty much the same kind of, you know, very manly, very masculine, heroic roles. And that's what he did almost throughout his entire career, with some exceptions.
And yet some people, I mean, obviously there's... As you touched on, that, you know, a lot of people have said that Moore was never perhaps the best actor. Equally, when you look at Moore's films, and I would confess that I'm out of all of them, there's some brilliant ones in there, and there's quite a few which probably go down the bottom of my list of Bonds. But in all of them, he brings something which I think other actors would struggle, not necessarily any of the other Bonds, but other actors struggled with, which is there was just a presence on the screen. Whether you thought he was a good or bad actor, he commanded your attention on the screen. But he did it in a very easygoing way as well. Whereas, say, somebody like Craig is quite brutal in the way that he commands the screen. For Moore, it was very much more of a gentle... You couldn't take your eyes off him because you knew there would be a raised eyebrow or a little kind of quirk or a tick on there that just dominated what was around it. And it's a very different type of way than the other Bonds for me.
Yeah, I think it is interesting because you do get the impression that obviously the Cold War was in full effect during the 70s. And yet here we are presented with a spy that is really so far removed from it. I mean, all he is interested in is the jet set lifestyle, isn't he? He's that whole sort of Wicker's World sort of feeling about it of, now I'm in Rio de Janeiro. Now I'm in Paris. It is that whole sort of thing, that sort of, it's a holiday show, really, what you've got. It's nothing like the sort of like Cold War spy dramas that you want or you think should be being portrayed.
I just had a sudden thought of Judith Chalmers as a Bond girl. But...
Do you know what? Yeah, I'm sure if you scoured the IMDb, it will probably say she was uncredited in From Russia with Love or something like that.
Sorry, Graham.
She was one of the gypsies, wasn't she?
But yes, you're completely right. There's and actually, there's a really that kind of escapism as well that he brought to it. And there
and
is
you needed that in the 70s.
Yes, you certainly. Yeah. I mean, obviously, I wasn't alive in the 70s, but I'm going to say that you probably did.
Yes, you did. Take it from us. Yeah, I mean, I do think I think that you know, We live in troubled times at the moment, and when you want to go to the cinema, I think this is I think people have tried to allude this about the fact that why there's so many superhero films around at the moment is the fact that because we live in troubled times, that we like to just soak ourselves in complete fantasy. I mean, it's got nothing to do with the fact that Marvel film rights all came up at the same time, and they all
got acquired by Disney, and Disney went
and CGI became really cheap. No, it's not anything to do with that. It's like a much higher ideal thing. This is actually more to do with like economic uncertainty and things like that. Well, yes, okay, let's go with that narrative. Yeah, and I think there is Simon Wender's book, The Man Who Saved Britain. Actually said about that in the 50s when Fleming started writing the books. He used to say that the 50s austere, horrible, grey times and reading these books of faraway places were obviously something that people just sucked up, and they just really wanted to get as much of as they could because it transported them away from a very horrible world into something that was brilliant. And I think that's what the Moore films did.
Because there is an awful lot of globe-trotting from one place to another, almost unnecessarily.
And it is the jet set period. It is that period of you know, when you know, transatlantic flight is suddenly a possibility.
Yeah, it's possible, but it's also, for most people, inaccessible.
Yeah.
And I mean, we have been through periods subsequent to that where, in fact, for many people, these things are quite doable. I mean, the low-cost flight revolution. Is, I mean, you can go to remote places, faraway places with strange-sounding names, and do it relatively
now,
cheaply.
I would say this now. I mean, I'm not a man of extravagant lifestyles, but I have been to places where part of the deal of the local area has been, we can take you to where they filmed this scene from a Bond film. And it has been very, very, very tempting sometimes. I thought, well, I'm not going to get on a coach for 4 hours just to see that nondescript island.
with Moore as well, and we sort of talked about this kind of light touch and the as Graham said, the jet set lifestyle as well. For me, Terry, as well, one of the things that's really interesting is you when you see kind of Bond starts to develop, some of them have really stuck to the same template. But if you look at Moore's Bond in Live and Let Die when he was first introduced, and then, you know, evolved, and by the time you get to Moonraker, they're a slightly different type of Bond by the time you get there.
Yeah, I think he's a bit more louche when he gets to Moonraker. I think that his Bond in Live and Let Die is a little bit more energised. Perhaps a bit more informed by his predecessors, and very much the actions of a younger actor. Well, he was in his 40s when he took on the role. It is strange because he comes across as being a very one-dimensional actor, but you're right to point out that actually his the way he tackled the role did change somewhat. You're right, when you got to Moonraker, I mean, it pretty much stayed the way that was. I mean, For Your Eyes Only was a departure of a movie, so we saw some different elements to him that the script introduced, which allowed him to be a little bit more cold-blooded, a bit more violent, a bit more down-to-earth, more ruthless. And by the time he's got to A View to a Kill. I mean, he's at a point where, you know, where it did, where it was quite apparent that, you know, that that really was a bridge too far for him. But no, I agree. It's wrong to suggest that he's a one-dimensional and he wasn't actually a very good actor. I think he was an extremely talented actor, but very understated, and a pro. So he knew. I doubt very much that Roger Moore was the actor who ever looked at a line, looked at a scene, and went, "I'm not doing it like this. I'm not doing it like that." I would imagine that Roger Moore is from that school of, you know, you have a job. This is your job. You do the job, and that's that. No matter how terrible it might be, or ill-conceived, you don't do that. And that's a good thing and a bad thing. It's the Michael Caine thing. Michael Caine never turns down a job.
And they're best of friends, aren't
they? And as a consequence, he's made some atrocious movies.
Yeah.
He's also made some brilliant movies. But
he not comes, as many as Michael Caine has made. Atrocious movies and great movies.
Indeed. No, he isn't wasn't as prolific. But then when you had the Bond gig going on for so many years, you know, he didn't need to make as many movies as Michael Caine. No. But I mean, he was a jobbing actor. I mean, in another world, he would have been doing rep for his entire career, and we probably wouldn't really have known his name. He'd be doing provincial theatres throughout the country, and you might, if you're the kind of person who went to provincial theatres regularly to watch, you know, a Francis Durbridge play, there would he be, and he'd make the, you know, he'd turn up and do a run on Corrie and stuff like that, and he would have done that. And he would have probably been well loved and well recognised, but he landed The Saint, and then he landed Bond, and that made him a superstar. But ultimately, I think he's at heart he had the professional ethic of someone who went, "This is the job. You do the job. You do what you're told. You hit your mark. You do your lines, and that's that."
Yeah,
He could have been a better actor if he'd been taking control of things more.
I think you're actually, you might be doing a little bit of a disservice there, because I think he was as much a businessman as he was an actor.
Right.
I mean, he bought the rights to The Saint before they actually made it.
This is true. Yeah.
So when he was making Ivanhoe, and so he was always there thinking ahead.
Mm.
And this is the sort of guy he was, and I think when he took the Bond role, he was already saying, "Well, actually, I know you gave Sean a cut in the last film of the profit." So,
but that's not the same thing as, I mean, what I mean is in terms of the craft of being an actor. I think he was happy to defer to the director, to the script writers, to the producers, and do to an extent what he was told.
Yeah.
I mean,
that was him being professional, I think. I think he just said, "Well, I know what you need and I know what you want.
Yeah, so I'm going to give you what you want."
Yeah.
Yeah. And maybe if he'd been a different type of actor, he might have said, "No, that's not right. I don't think we should do that. I don't think we should do it like that." Mm. Maybe he's the kind of guy who's probably just left it to the experts to do, and he just did what he's told. He may have had a more diverse career as a consequence, but you know,
you can't ever imagine him, or you could never imagine a more era churning out a film like Quantum of Solace, which was very, very heavily, almost Craig had a very heavy influence in that.
Mm.
And that's not something you could really ever see under Moore, because Moore went with the direction that they went in. And when it didn't, that direction didn't quite work with Moore, as in something like For Your Eyes Only, it was very apparent that it didn't fit Moore's style. But I wouldn't imagine he ever turned around and said, "This is not my Bond."
Although, in fairness, he might not have had to, because, I mean, it's well known that him and Cubby used to play backgammon for hours and ends on set. So there was the friendship there. Yeah. So an awful lot of this probably didn't need to happen in script meetings.
Yeah, there's probably a lot of directors who mistrusted him because of his relationship with the producers,
or indeed deferred to him.
Yeah,
I mean,
they were jobbing directors anyway, weren't they? So they weren't there for the. But they were just there to make films.
The whole Bond franchise is franchise led.
Mm.
It's only been in the last few movies with Sam Mendes where they've brought in an auteur to come in and interpret.
And he's
Bond.
Brought in his own team.
And he's brought in his own team. But actually, prior to that, it's been very much a Broccoli thing. We know Bond. we know what's best.
Yeah.
We take the creative lead.
Yeah.
And you fall in or you're out.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that happened a lot.
And that's what made it work, because it wasn't just directors and producers and artists. It was Maurice Binder. It was Ken Adams.
John Barry. Yeah. Yeah. The same people the way down getting picked up.
And exactly movie after that movie. Whole
yeah. Because they understood what was required,
and then everyone went and copied it.
Yeah, it's a barnstorming success.
Well, I think that's an interesting thing, Gary, isn't it? Because I think that's everyone looks at him and says, "Oh, it's a bit camp." But the thing is, even by this stage, Bond had been parodied so many times.
It's almost like
there's no direction. Or the people know the parody more than they know.
Mm.
The actual Bond, isn't it?
Yes. And there's an interesting bit on the parody thing with Moore, I think. Because on one hand, as you say, by that stage, Bond was well established.
Yeah.
And there was a lot to parody on Bond. And was parodied both in terms of serious films, took a lot off there, but also more comic films took a lot off there. But then I think what Moore did was almost... the Moore era, and Moore... obviously plays a big part in this, was really condensed that kind of, with those elements of parody and put them into really, made such a kind of, I guess when you look at films like Mike Myers, for example, and his Goldmember, Goldmember and Austin Powers.
Are we making an Austin Powers reference?
I think I dinged a bit earlier.
Obligatory, signpost. Obligatory Austin Powers reference. But a lot of that came from the Moore era, when you look at where everything ties back to.
Yeah,
and that's what I think when spy movies come out and they have a level of spoof and there's a reference back to Bond, it is inevitably the Moore era, which has pretty much defined what Bond
is. It's true. I mean, like what you say with Austin Powers, a lot of the visual elements of that are based in the Connery era, but the way he carries it off...
Diamonds Are Forever, You Only Live
that
Twice.
That sort of thing is, but the actual way he carries it off...
Austin Powers is closer to Roger's Bond than he is to Sean's
Bond. He is Roger's Bond in a late Connery film.
In a Ken Adam sort of like underground complex 1967 or something like that.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting as well for me that when you look at the, I guess, post-career of the Bonds, when they finished, Connery did actually some very interesting, very enjoyable films as well. He always was Sean Connery, but he took some really interesting film choices. Dalton, obviously, very classically trained actor and went back to doing what he did best.
Rocketeer.
Yeah. For example,
The Rocketeer. The Rocketeer is a great film.
Yeah,
I have completely forgotten about that.
The Rocketeer is an immense film. Yeah, and he is superb. Anyway,
carry on.
When Tim Dalton dies, we can talk about that.
But now all he's going to think about is Jennifer Connelly.
This is very, very true.
Actually, no, it's a bit unsettling now when you watch The Rocketeer, because she's about 20 in it, and she's really age inappropriate now.
Brosnan as well has sort of carved out a sort of slightly, you know, lighter roles as well, and no doubt Craig will go on and probably do some strange choices as well. But Moore pretty much just went, he pretty much stepped back and went, that's it, I feel like I'm done at this point because I'm defined by what I am. There were a few films afterwards, but he wasn't particularly prolific once he finished either.
No. It's cameos basically.
There's a few
animated films he does the voice for
Certain he didn't have a vehicle after Vito Kill. Maybe you were mistaken about that.
Mm.
We've got his IMDb
profile. But he was close to 60, wasn't he?
We haven't mentioned so far, and it might be appropriate to mention now, a UNICEF ambassador.
Yeah.
And something that took up a tremendous amount of his time, after he'd finished with the Bond. So that it might well be that this was, he moved away from acting and then moved into his public service work.
I don't know where you're going to go, but I think it is worth sort of trying to put those later films, those last three, in context.
Yes, definitely.
For Your Eyes Only, Octopussy, and A View to a Kill. What has to be remembered, of course, is the whole hubbub around Never Say Never Again, which came out the same summer as Octopussy.
Mm.
And how the, I was going to say, fear of Eon to that they were going to lose something in compared to Never Say Never Again, meant that they probably held on to Roger for much longer than they thought. I don't think it was all about the fact that they couldn't get Brosnan, because they could have got anyone, really.
I think that
they weren't sold on.
That hadn't occurred to me. I think that's a really good point. What I would add to that would be to say that I thought that Roger was fantastic in Octopussy.
Yeah.
Which was the movie, obviously, that went up against Never Say Never Again. I was around. I went to see both of those pictures at the cinema more than once, being a big James Bond fan as I did. And I, through osmosis, you got the impression that, yes, that fear was there.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Sean had such a hold over the franchise. And when I was growing up, my parents and friends of my parents were of the view that Sean was the definitive James Bond, and anybody else from that point on was basically a knockoff.
whereas people of our age,
yeah,
it was basically, well, this guy's the film Bond, this guy's the telly Bond, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
This is the guy who was in like those old films that I see on the telly, and this is the guy who I go to the pictures to go see.
I mean, I imagine my younger James Bond fans have a totally different perspective on that now.
But I think
at the time,
yeah,
and his shadow loomed large even at this point in, what was it, 86, is it? I forget what the exact
83,
earlier than that. Yeah. Okay, all right, it's a bit earlier than that. And so when that movie came out, understandably, there would have been some fear that it would have undermined and possibly damaged the franchise.
But they're both films played off each other as well.
It's a fine movie, and Roger does it well. And in retrospect, I think we look at that and compare the two, and I would suggest to you that Octopussy is the more enduring film.
Oh, certainly.
Than Never Say Never Again.
As well with Octopussy, which is a really fascinating one, because obviously that's the point where, you know, we'll get View to a Kill out after that, which, as we said, felt like a slight step too far on there. But you look at Moore's performance in Octopussy, and it is really good. It's such an ridiculously entertaining film, and he plays everything so well. I've always kind of wondered with that, if he just thought, well, I know this is probably going to be my last one, so I'm going to give it absolutely everything. And wasn't quite... I don't think at that stage he was expecting to be asked back for another one. And I think that reflects in his performance, because he's, you know, he's the consummate pro, as we've said. And there is that sort of go out on a high.
That's a really good observation. I think it's another good one, because I think he actually... Moore, as an actor, meets his match in this film with Louis Jourdan, isn't it? In the fact that you've got the French equivalent of Roger Moore on the other side of the backgammon table.
Amazing actor. Yeah. He was. And what an amazing character as well.
But he played an archetypal Frenchman, doesn't he?
Yes.
This suave player, handsome man who was obviously he is the French version of Roger Moore, isn't he?
Is there any issues with that movie in terms of the fact that it's set in India? Is there stuff that we're missing, perhaps, about that? Is it a little bit too colonial or about that? I have hugely fond memories of that movie.
I'm sure there are.
There probably are, aren't there?
I'm sure we're probably
not picking up because we're just so enamoured with it.
Yeah, but then again, I don't know, because it is weird. I mean, the... the whole Vijay Amritraj.
Yeah,
it's played for laughs.
It's played for laughs until he meets a really grisly end.
In fairness,
actually, that's one of the more memorable scenes in that movie. And in fact, in Roger Moore's performance as James Bond is his, the reaction to that in that initial. I mean, life is cheap in James Bond films, and the next joke is only 30 seconds away, even if someone's been, lacerated to death by some hideous sort of like circular saw. But I thought that, despite the fact that he's emerging from this faux crocodile, his concern and the sadness, I think, works really quite nicely, even though it's not a great scene.
Those little bits there are actually quite Fleming. There's rare bits of sort of like Fleming-esque Bonds that are in Moore films, because you don't really get a lot of them in.
The idea of him giving a shit about somebody else around him. I mean, normally henchmen or his cronies, I mean, they live, they die, and he doesn't really care. Bond, you know, but this was different. I mean, I mean that film works really well because of the supporting cast is fantastic as well. Stephen Berkoff and Walter Jurtel and Louis Jourdan and Maud Adams. Absolutely, you know,
it's a
great cast.
It's a brilliant, brilliant cast.
And all working in service of the movie as well, which is great.
And lots of Q as well.
And lots of Q.
Yeah.
And Roger does a superb job in keeping that, you know, keeping that going. And leading that movie, and as particularly in the context of the fact that there is, you know, a rival film out there, which could actually be injurious. So I think if you're thinking about the importance of maintaining and preserving the franchise that goes on for decades later and hopefully decades into the future, that was a really important film. Mm. That it was important that film be successful and be good, because it could actually have scuppered the franchise if things had gone badly.
Mm.
And you have to look to the lead, the senior pro in there, and that would be Roger Moore, and you know, give him all credit that he's due for keeping the franchise, you know, on the straight and narrow, and as it was. And okay, so they gave him another one, maybe as a nod or a thanks, and perhaps it was one too many, but nevertheless.
One of the things that you...
Still a good film, though.
I love it. I love A View to a Kill.
I love it, yeah.
It's ridiculous.
This is a great thing about being a Bond fan.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing about being a Bond of any kind of, like, franchise, is that even the stuff that you think is shit, you still love.
Yeah, well, this is it, because it's interesting, because we're doing this podcast here. We were going to be doing the World Cup of Bond films, weren't
we? We were.
On this episode. I'm really glad we did this one, but, you know, we will do that.
We
one.
Will do
Before
that.
Before you go to Australia, we
hopefully
sure
we'll
want it in
to do. Yeah. But Views to Kill would have been up there.
Oh,
it would have been up there, even though it's an atrocious film.
It would have been. It would have been like the Costa Rica.
Did you read, I don't know whether you got the chance, so I don't remember too much of it, but Grace Jones was interviewed, asked to comment about Roger Moore's passing, and her remarks were incredibly gracious and very sensitive and very classy and very nice indeed. And I just thought I'd just drop that in there, because that was.
I might hunt them down.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't say much, but she just recalls her time working with Roger and her memories of it, and what a great pro he was and what a great guy he was, and that was very nice.
Yeah, he's and that came across, I think, in all the tributes that you got. There was a real sort of sense, and a lot of the stories that came out as well weren't just about sort of, you know, you always get tributes whenever any actor passes away, but they felt like these were genuinely heartfelt, and a lot of the stories...
Yeah, there's tributes, aren't there?
Mm-hmm. And this really felt like it summed up just... the impression, if somebody sort of who hadn't really ever watched Bond films, perhaps was maybe kind of, you know... younger person, you know, teenager or early 20s, perhaps hasn't really got into Bond, and read the tributes, the sense that you'd get was just what an enormously nice man he was as well. Not just professional, not just, you know, the face of one of the most successful movie franchises of all time, but just a really lovely person. Mm.
Yeah, it's one of the things that I thought about when I saw the tributes coming in was the fact that it's usually him giving out the tributes. The glowing tributes to all the people that he's worked with, and he's worked with some amazing people, and unfortunately who have passed before him.
Yes,
and one of this whole thing. Well, his book was called Last Man Standing, because basically, like, he's been in the
almost
industry
everybody
for years, and everyone he's worked with is basically dead.
Apart from Michael Caine.
Yeah. but all these great people that he worked with, and that was one thing I took home from the evening show that I went to see with him, and about all the great talks with him. But it did sort of open my eyes to the fact that actually the way he works with other people, the way he almost instantly makes this sort of double act thing going on. And I think that's one thing about that is really quite good about the Moore films.
Mm.
I think he had a couple of films with Bernard Lee, and he worked quite well with him. But I think with Q, he had probably the best on-screen
tremendous chemistry.
Yeah,
those little vignettes that they had, sort of like usually sort of like somewhere through the third reel where everyone would take a break and go and visit Q and stock up on the gear. And the audience would take a break. And, you know, and then we realised that Q was in and we had a, we could have a little bit of a laugh and enjoy the bioplay. But no other Bond character, Bond actor had that chemistry, in my opinion, than Roger Moore and Desmond Llewellyn and Bond and Q in those movies, to my mind.
It was one of, to me, and I think it's always just, again, incredibly touching because it is, it's two actors who clearly enjoy being in each other's company. And that comes across on the screen, that just how comfortable they are and how much they just seem to be just enjoying that moment, and they relish those bits. Because I think I remember saying that, reading an interview with Desmond Llewellyn ages ago, and in it he basically said Connery just used to get bored and fiddle with the gadgets in between takes.
Joe, one of my favourite scenes of the two of them is in For Your Eyes Only, when they're in the little room and they're making the little Photoshop.
Nose cue, not a banana.
Exactly, it's hilarious. And I think it's because we actually saw that film. I've probably gone through this anecdote many times on this podcast, but we saw For Your Eyes Only on the last day of term, I think, in 1983. And they got us in the hall and they showed us For Your Eyes Only, and it was brilliant and we all had a great time. But yeah, we were laughing our faces off with when they did this funny, what a banana. It was hilarious. Love that bit.
Yeah, there's lots to love in there, and there's lots of
well, those particular set pieces were also the classic Q branch set pieces with the, you know,
balls Q,
and you know,
having trouble keeping it up, Q,
and you know, and all of that all chucked in there, and you know, really spectacular scenes, well resourced,
but it was also sort of what's going on in the background as well, the whole sort of like exploding, like the big blow up. Well, airbag in the telephone box and things like that.
Yeah, and the splinter, the splinter that sprung out and smashed the face of them.
And the little tray that goes along the table.
Oh, I love that tray. I have no idea what that tray was for. I don't think that had any genuine practical purpose, but that tray. Great. But it did look great. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I think interestingly, I did think that whilst there's still, you know, you don't know whether we're going to get another Craig film or not, but I think he was starting to get that in Spectre. He was starting to get that relationship with Ben Whishaw.
I think Ben Whishaw probably only took the role if he could have that sort of chance to have that type of thing.
Yeah, and that's the nearest it's come to in there.
Yeah,
but it is, and it's so hard to have an actor who actually, again, you can have some actors, going back to the earlier point, who dominate, and then there's others who include and do their best work, who get
more from the people they're acting with.
Yes. I mean, and when you're the franchise leader, you're the lead role, and you've got an ensemble cast that you've got to bring with you.
I wonder if Moore got that a lot more from The Persuaders, actually being in a double act almost. Mm. With Tony,
And
Tony Curtis, someone like Tony Curtis, who has worked in double acts in films as well, and gets that same sort of thing. And like the best Tony Curtis films are the ones where he's starring with like Jack Lemmon.
So Roger's happy to be somewhat more understated, I think, and allow others to flourish around him.
Yeah.
The work he did on View to a Kill with Christopher Walken, who is a magnificent actor. And it has to be said, I mean, since Roger has died, I have taken some time to reevaluate him as an actor, because I think it's very easy to just simply go by conventions that he's not a very diverse, not a very varied actor, the eyebrow thing, you know, and the cheap quip, and that actually he wasn't that good an actor. And then, you know, you think about some of the scenes that he had with other, you know, shall we say, more celebrated actors, and think, well, this proves my point. And I think about that scene with in San Francisco in the mayor's office with Roger and Christopher Walken, and you think, oh well, you know, Christopher Walken just acts Roger off the screen, but a kinder way of putting it is actually that Roger allows Christopher Walken to completely shine in that scene, which is necessary because he is the villain, and we have to understand just how nasty and villainous he is, because he goes on to do some unspeakable things later in the movie, and so it's important that we get that. And actually, Roger does a fine job, and I think that he is obviously somewhat limited by the roles that he was given. But I feel that actually, had his career taken a different turn, he would probably have been a very, very diverse, perhaps not as successful, but certainly a very diverse, maybe not as famous, maybe successful, because he obviously had the business side of things, but he may not have been the superstar that he was.
Yeah.
But I still think he would have been a fine actor.
Well, I think that you know, it's certainly not the first time he would have come across an actor like Christopher Walken, even in the Bond franchise. I mean, you've got him and Stephen Berkoff together there. I mean,
yes.
You've got serious actor there going up against you. So, yeah, it's...
That scene there.
Yeah.
I mean, Berkoff is brilliant. Berkoff is a brilliant actor and razor sharp theatre actor.
Yeah.
You know, and
brings so much to that film.
And the scene in the train carriage between him and Moore.
Being on a train carriage, always
good. Always a great sound. Yeah, yeah. If you can possibly
if do you something can on restrict a train. Bond to a train carriage, it's going to go. And you can't do it in Octopussy because he's got to get onto the top of it.
Yes.
He's got to have a knife fight up there.
Yeah, yeah.
With twins.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Kurt Jurgens, he plays up again.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, not a
Christopher Lee.
And Christopher Lee. Yeah. These are top-notch screen actors with, in some instances, a huge amount of experience.
And a huge amount of presence on screen as well. Certainly in the case of Christopher Lee.
And he's absolutely fine. Like, those scenes are really, really enjoyable. And actually, on reflection, it's foolish to think that they are only owned by those other actors and not by Roger, and Roger doesn't make any significant contribution to them. He must have done.
Yeah.
And this, I think, is why they kept bringing him back, because he was just so damn good at that, and I think that's the thing about him, is his professionalism is the thing that is probably the best thing, best quality of him. Sorry.
No, that's fine. There's obviously so much more we can talk about. One thing I did want to briefly bring in and touch on as well was, you obviously say, you know, would he have been as famous if he hadn't got the Bond role? He still had a fair level of fame when he came into the role, obviously through The Saint.
Yes.
Oh yeah, certainly. Well, The Saint, Ivanhoe, for people who go back even that far. And you know, The Persuaders as well, which was a huge series.
It was short lived, but then obviously it was one of these deals where, because Tony Curtis is just such box office, that the likelihood of being able to nail him down, extraordinary. To get Tony Curtis to do
that's because it just gave them the chance to fly around the world for amazing places.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. And then of course, like Bond, you got the Bond gig as well. So,
yes, I mean, those movies, Persuaders, it's got a great theme by John Barry, and it's very cool looking, but they're not very. They don't hold up those.
No.
I mean, and in fairness, the same can be said about The Saint as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, he was. Because they wanted him, didn't they, earlier for Bond, and he was tied to The Saint, as the story goes. Mm. It's a bit, in the same way that Pierce was tied to Remington Steele and couldn't go in when they wanted him to go in and had to come in a little bit later. So they'd always kind of earmarked him for that role. So, I mean, he was always going to play James Bond. So really, the parallel universe, there's unlikely to be any kind of parallel universe in which Roger Moore isn't playing James Bond at some point in his career.
He is a fixed point in time.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So we've talked for about 45 minutes, and I think there's so much more that we could probably easily talk for another 45 as well. So I'm going to sort of start going, OK, let's wrap this up. But let's wrap this up on a classic Moore area, which is, I'm going to ask you both what your favourite Moore quip is.
Right, OK. My favourite Moore quip is from... it's from The Man with the Golden Gun, and it's when he's trying to get the bullet, which is the belly button lucky charm that the belly dancer has.
Oh, I've lost my charm.
Not from where I'm standing.
It's a great movie.
The whole thing about it. The fact that he swallows it in a comedic fashion as well. in the process of kissing her stomach and like, then getting hit on the back of her head.
Which, of course, is nonsense.
Yeah. However, no, but, it's good. It works. It's hilarious. Yeah. And like, yeah. It gives you some.
I mean, you don't swallow bullets.
Well,
I mean, bullets are. You know.
Yeah.
Anyway, this is pointless. This is pointless.
Yes. Anyway, that's my favourite quip.
Terry. My favourite quip, one-liner, if you will, is from the film Octopussy, and it's when he exposes Kamal Khan for cheating at backgammon, and it's quite simply he just rolls the dice. He nicks Kamal Khan's loaded dice, rolls them, doesn't even look at them. And just goes, double sixes. Fancy that. And for years, whenever I play Batman, Graham and I play Batman 1, and every time we roll a happy double six, shall we say.
Double
sixes. Fancy that. The implication being that the opponent has cheated.
And the best thing about that, of course, is he goes full eyebrow on that.
Yes,
one.
Absolutely. It's a glorious moment in what is a glorious film.
And I think those ones are the ones that really kind of make Bond.
Come on, you have yours. What's yours? Let's hear it.
I'm slightly embarrassing. I was going to go for exactly the same one in Octopussy.
Oh, really?
Oh, which was so.
It's, oh, I'm sorry.
We
really should have come on.
We should have come on. The other thing, that just always sticks in my mind a bit as well is Moonraker, where he's just thrown the henchman off building and lands in a drum, head first down into a drum, and I think that is that's just one of my, again, it's that the eyebrow and the delivery that come off the back of that.
His name's Jaws. He kills people. Not socially. That's the first time.
Not socially, yeah. His name's Jaws. He kills people. Fantastic.
Yeah, and there's so many. And again, I mean, Moonraker is not one Bond film that I particularly have. Or I never used to have much love for it.
Until you started talking to us.
And then you realise how wrong you were. How brilliant that film is.
There's still the space bit at the end that still gets me, but there are...
And how we've radicalised you.
You have brainwashed me into liking Moonraker. Yeah. Or at least liking up until the point where they fly up into space.
And how it makes much more sense to get a knife thrower in a floating hearse to try and kill James Bond rather than a couple of guys with machine guns and a speedboat. No, we'll go with the guy with the hearse.
I think
that's the best part of Moonraker.
Moonraker also, almost for me as well, felt like it was peak Moore. There is that point where there's that level of ridiculousness. There's the quips.
Well, he looks great in it. He's great in the film.
Yeah.
And he's just at that right point where he looks great in the action sequences. And that movie is superb. It really, I mean, it does go, it is pure fantasy, obviously.
Yes.
But this is fine, because it's late 70s.
Yeah.
It's just after Star Wars.
Yeah, come on, what's it going up against? It's going against Star Trek the Motion Picture and Black Hole. Come on, it's great. Come on.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not certain. Yeah, okay.
And Superman, that's what we've got. It's
79, so it is, yes. Yeah, right. Black Hole. Tier motion picture.
Yeah, a lot of giants around there.
Yeah,
and it stands up.
Some big beasts there.
I bet people have watched that on the rest of all those ones. With the exception of Superman.
I think. Well, I reckon a lot of people have watched motion picture because Star Trek.
People just watch Star Trek. You have.
Yes. Oh, right, and you haven't, of course. So
that I think brings us to a nice wrap and conclusion on there. And really, as I say, I think there's so much more that you can talk about more, and regular listeners of people who've been here since the beginning, all five of
them. I think this is not the last podcast we're going to do together.
Oh, no, it's...
So I imagine that Roger Moore will come up.
He will.
Yes. Again.
He will come up, you say.
There'll be no trouble keeping it up.
It's just so easy to lapse into innuendo.
It is.
and the innuendo delivery. Anyway, so I think that brings it to a nice conclusion, gentlemen. So we'll recharge our glasses of vodka martini, or rather I won't. I managed to get through a podcast despite being horrifically hungover, and I'm amazed that I could speak
well done.
Through this.
Well done, Gary.
Yeah, well done, Gary. I was actually...
We were expecting you to drop to the floor at any moment.
Genuinely, I did worry
if I'd really be able to speak.
You've
done amazing work. Yeah. Ever the pro. Yeah. Roger would be proud.
Roger would be proud.
I knew what I had to do. Yeah. I turned in.
You hit your mark.
You hit your mark and you said your lines. Good man.
And on that note, we will leave it there, and we will bid a fond farewell to really a man who was Bond, if nothing else. So thank you very much, Terry. Thank you very much, Graham. And thank you very much, listeners. Please do on social media at Odd Job Pod or like our Facebook page. And we sometimes can be a bit, go on, comment if you want. But here, I think we definitely say... Any memories of Roger Moore, your favourite bits, we would genuinely love to hear them, because I think when I heard the news, all I wanted to do was leave work for the day and go back and just watch the Bond catalogue, and that's kind of what I did, really. Didn't actually leave work until I was meant to, but then got
back. Yeah, because you're a pro.
Because I'm a pro. You're a pro. I go in, I deliver my lines.
You don't just go, Roger Moore's dying, I must take the half day.
No. I must go home and watch the Wild Geese.
Which is what I did.
Yes.
So thank you very much. Please do leave your memories and comments on social media. I hope you've enjoyed it. And the Odd Job Pod will return.
Damn right it will.
I'm Skippy. Thank you very much, listeners.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Time. A hypothetical fist fight takes place between Simon Templar, the Saint, and Roger Moore, James Bond, 007. Who wins? Any thoughts on that, Roger? 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 Roger?